Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
In 1989, a neonatologist based in Canada named Dr. Xu Li published a research paper on air embolisms in newborn babies. It was a technical contribution to a narrow field of medicine, the kind of paper that gets cited a few dozen times by other specialists and then settles back into the back archives of medical journals. Li went on to become one of the most respected figures in the field, eventually serving as professor at the University of Toronto and receiving the Order of Canada for his work reducing infant mortality. He probably never imagined his decades-old research would one day sit at the center of a British murder trial. Then, years later, he learned how his paper had been used. It had been cited as key medical evidence in the prosecution of Lucy Letby. The prosecution's expert had drawn on Lee's findings to support the conclusion that several babies at the Countess of Chester Hospital had been killed by deliberately injected air. When Li read how his work had been applied, he was alarmed. He believed his research had been misinterpreted. He believed it had been used to support conclusions it could not actually sustain. So he did something that almost never happens in cases this high profile. He assembled a panel and reviewed every single case from the trial. Their conclusion, announced in February 2025, they found no medical evidence of murder of any of the 17 cases. Not most of them, all of them. The man whose own research had helped convict Lucy Letby now believes the conviction may be fundamentally wrong. This is part four of our five-part series on the Lucy Letby case. The first three episodes walk through what allegedly happened in that neonatal unit, how the hospital failed to act on its own doctor's warnings, and how the prosecution built the case that convicted her in a Manchester courtroom. This episode is about the doubt, not the speculation, not the internet conspiracy theories, not the armchair detectives looking for attention. The credentialed, peer-reviewed, professionally serious doubt that has accumulated around the Lucy Letby conviction since the verdict was handed down in August of 23. Doctors, statisticians, criminologists, legal experts who had looked at the evidence and concluded that something's wrong here. Their voices do not prove Letby is innocent. The legal system has not overturned her conviction. Two appeals have been denied, but the doubt is real. It is professional. And it is growing. And anyone who wants to understand this case has to take it seriously because it's part of the story. Part of the story that should have been told long ago. But I guess better late than never, right? As we go through this chapter in our story, part four of five, if you could press subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast. Or if you're watching us on YouTube, press subscribe, hit the bell so you don't miss any of our videos and our notifications. And so you don't miss this whole story. There's a lot to go through in the Lucy Letby case. It is a fascinating one. And give us your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube as we go through it. Those links are in the description. The challenges to the conviction did not arrive with one dramatic revelation. They accumulated slowly at first, then was with increasing momentum from sources that could not be easily dismissed. In May of 24, The New Yorker published a long-form investigation by staff writer Rachel Aviv that questioned multiple aspects of the case. The article was initially blocked from publication in the United Kingdom because of an ongoing court order related to Letby's retrial, but it remained accessible in the United States and circulated widely online. Isn't it amazing that we still live in a world where it's like, oh, we're going to block this in our territory and assume like the words can't get out anywhere? It's just, it's sillily stupid. Aviv spent months reporting on the case, and her article highlighted issues that had received little attention during the trial itself. She wrote about chronic understaffing on the neonatal unit, about hygiene problems, including drainage issues and sewage backflow in unit sinks, about the fact that only one specialist neonatologist was available to the unit during the period in question. The piece raised the possibility that the cluster of infant deaths could be explained, at least in part, by environmental and systematic failures rather than deliberate harm. Then came the statisticians, and their critique was even more devastating to the prosecution's narrative. The Royal Statistical Society held a formal meeting in September of 24 to discuss the use of numerical evidence in the Letby trial. The staffing chart, the visual centerpiece it had so persuasively suggested Letby was always present, came under intense scrutiny. Critics pointed out that the chart only included incidents where Letby was on duty. It excluded at least six deaths and collapses of babies that occurred when she was not working. By selecting only the events that supported the prosecution's theory, the chart created a misleading impression of perfect correlation. Professor Peter Green, a former president of the Royal Statistical Society, publicly questioned the chart's methodology. He noted that Letby had been working extra shifts during the period in question, which mathematically increased the likelihood that she would appear on any randomly selected shift schedule. The visual that had seemed so damning to jurors began to look to statisticians like a textbook example of selection bias. Jane Hutton, a medical statistician initially hired by the police as a consultant during the early stages of the investigation, became one of the most prominent critics of the statistical evidence after the trial. According to her account, the Crown Prosecution Service had instructed police to discontinue her line of inquiry before her analysis was complete. After the verdict, she went public with her concerns, arguing that the statistical case against Letby did not hold water, that the numerical foundation of the prosecution's theory was fundamentally flawed. I guess that's almost putting it nicely. Manipulated might be a better word. The medical evidence underwent equally intense re-examination. Dr. Shuley's expert panel reviewed the critical records and concluded that the skin discoloration cited as evidence of air embolism was actually consistent with hypoxia, a simple lack of oxygen, which is one of the most common complications in premature infants. Hypoxia does not require deliberate harm. It can occur naturally in babies whose lungs and circulatory systems are still developing. According to the panel, the diagnostic features that the prosecution's expert had described as markers of air embolism were not, in fact, the kind of skin discoloration that air embolism produces. The science, they argued, had been misread. Kind of a big deal. Multiple NHS consultant neonatologists came forward independently to challenge the testimony of Dr. Dwight Evans, the prosecution's primary medical expert. Sylvania Dimitrova, an NHS consultant, and Roger Norwich, a medical expert, filed formal complaints with the General Medical Council regarding Evans' evidence. Dimitrova told The Guardian that the theories proposed in court were not plausible, and that the prosecution was, in her view, full of medical inaccuracies. She did not assert Letby's innocence. What she said was more careful and in some ways more damning. She saw no proof of guilt. Evans rejected the criticism and noted that the defense had been free to call its own expert witnesses at trial and had chosen not to. The handwritten notes received perhaps the most consequential re-examination. Reporting after the trial revealed that the so-called confession notes had allegedly been written on the advice of a counselor as part of a therapeutic exercise to manage extreme stress. Leppi had been reportedly told to put her intrusive thoughts on paper as a coping strategy during a period when she had been removed from clinical duties and was under internal investigation. Sources close to the case said this context was not presented to the jury during trial. Professor Gilsey, one of the world's leading experts on confession evidence and false confessions, has written a report arguing that the notes should not be interpreted as admissions of guilt. He emphasized the impact that the accusations and the isolation were having on Leppi's mental state at the time the notes were written. The same notes that prosecutors has highlighted in their opening speech. The words, "I am evil, I did this," were now being recontextualized as the writings of a woman in psychological collapse, not the confessions of a calculated killer. Even the procedural evidence has come under question. The door swipe records that the prosecution had used to place Leppi in specific locations at specific times were found after the first trial to have been mislabeled. The Crown Prosecution Service confirmed in August of 24 that swipe data from one of the unit's doors had its entries and exits reversed. The CPS could not confirm whether data for other doors had been correctly labeled. Cheshire Police reviewed the impact and concluded that the incorrect data had been relied upon in evidence relating to 9 infants, though it played a central role only in the case of child K, for whom Leppi was not convicted at the first trial. The second door to the unit did not record entries or exits at all, meaning that the door swipe evidence could never have provided a complete picture of who entered and left the ward. It's not a minor technical footnote. It means that one of the prosecution's tools for establishing presence and timing was demonstrably wrong in at least one significant respect. And then there's the comparison that has stopped people cold. Statistician Richard Gill was one of the first to draw the parallel publicly. The case of Lucia de Burgh. De Burgh was a Dutch pediatric nurse convicted in 2003 of murdering patients at 3 hospitals in The Hague. The evidence against her was strikingly similar to the evidence against Lucia Leppi. She was present during a cluster of unexplained deaths. Statistical correlation suggested her presence was unlikely to be coincidence. Medical experts interpreted clinical events as evidence of deliberate harm. She was sentenced to life in prison. And in 2008, the case was reopened. In 2009, a Dutch court accepted that the deaths had been natural and that de Burgh was completely innocent. She spent 6 years in prison for crimes that had never occurred. The statistical evidence had been wrong. The medical interpretation had been wrong. The conviction had been a catastrophic miscarriage of justice. Gill, who was directly involved in overturning de Burgh's conviction, has stated publicly that the Leppi case follows the same pattern. He is not alone in drawing that comparison. It was discussed in detail at the Royal Statistical Society meeting. The parallel does not prove Lucy Leppi is innocent, but it proves that this exact category of case, circumstantial, statistical, built on contested medical interpretation, has been catastrophically wrong before. And the people who helped fix that previous wrongful conviction are saying the same warning signs are present right here in this case. In January 26, a new development added weight to the defense's argument. The Crown Prosecution Service announced it would not bring additional charges against Leppi relating to 9 more babies that police had wanted to prosecute. The CPS stated that the evidential threshold requiring to bring further charges had not been met. Lepe's defense team argued that this decision implicitly undermined the original convictions, since the same kinds of evidence that had supported the first trial had now been deemed insufficient for additional cases. The CPS maintained that its decision had no bearing on the existing convictions, which remained legally upheld, but the optics were unmistakable. Prosecutors, who had once been oh so confident to bring 18 total charges, had now declined to bring 11 more, despite police pushing for them. Then in February 26, Lepe's barrister Mark McDonald submitted a sweeping dossier to the Criminal Cases Review Commission, containing 31 expert reports from 26 international medical specialists. McDonald has repeatedly stated publicly that Lepe has always maintained her innocence and that the case must be referred back to the Court of Appeal as a matter of urgency. The CCRC is the only remaining legal route open to her, since two previous applications for leave to appeal have been refused by the Court of Appeal. The CCRC confirmed in February 26 that a review of Lepe's convictions is in fact underway, though it cautioned that the process will be lengthy given the volume and complexity of the evidence. The CCRC operates on a specific legal standard. It does not determine innocence or guilt. It looks for a real possibility that a conviction would not be upheld if referred back to the Court of Appeal. That standard is high, and the commission has been criticized in recent years for being slow and conservative in referring cases, but it is now examining one of the most scrutinized convictions in the country. And its decision, whenever it comes, we'll reshape this case in one direction or another. As of this recording, Lucy Lepe's convictions remain legally upheld. She is serving 15 whole life sentences in a high-security women's prison in England. She maintains her innocence. The medical experts who challenge the evidence continue to publish their analyses. The families of the babies who died continue to live with the knowledge that the case is being relitigated in public every time a new documentary airs or a new expert speaks. There is no comfortable place to land on this case right now. If Lepe is guilty, the conviction should withstand rigorous expert scrutiny, and the doubt should eventually be answered. If the evidence is flawed, that truth matters just as much, because a wrongful conviction does not bring justice to anyone, least of all to the families who deserve to know what really happened to their children. In our final episode of this series, coming up next, we step back from Lucy Lepe herself and look at the system that produced all of it. The Third Wall Inquiry and its forthcoming report, the parents who are still fighting to have their children's death certificates corrected, the three hospital executives under criminal investigation, the coronial inquests, and the reckoning that extends far beyond one nurse on one ward in one English district hospital. Certainty is the one thing this case does not currently provide. And the people demanding more of it on every side are not wrong to do so. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I know, you think you're going down this road and you're like, this is an easy one to figure out. It looks pretty damning. Oh, wait. When people present information to you in a very specific way, it's almost like marketing a murder, you know? If we market it this way, we're going to get the people to take action. If you're to market certain products in the United States, certain food products in the United States, and like really get into the gritty details of what's actually in them, no one would buy them. But if you make them look delicious, if you talk about them doing this and that, and so good, and look at that, but you omit other facts, you can convince people to buy it. You do the same with murder. If you make it look one way and you omit a lot of other facts over here that actually change the context a bit, you can get people to buy that too. court systems are really just marketing with very, very serious consequences. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. Press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts. If you're not there already, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. You will find us, and then you can take us wherever you go. Hello, everybody on the other side of the pond. I know we got a lot of you over there. Thank you for joining us on this case, and I hope you'll join us for others as well. All right. We'll continue the conversation in the comments. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.